Howdy, folks. Rob Wolf here. We're back with another episode of the Payload Solution Podcast. I can't believe we keep doing this stuff. I can't believe you keep coming back, but you do. So that's awesome. And I was just teasing our next wonderful guest, Nina Teicholz, who is the author of The Big Fat Surprise, that this may, in fact, be the end of her career showing up on this show. This is the place that career nutrition-oriented careers go to die. Nina, how are you doing?
I'm really happy to be here, and I don't believe a word you just said.
Oh, okay, cool. Well, it sounds good. So how are you doing?
I'm really well, thanks.
We got to meet at the Food Fight episode on John Stossel, Fox News, which was super cool, and you did a very, very nice solo bit on that. I was quite impressed. You actually got John to eat some bacon on camera, I believe, during your section, right?
Yeah, he spit it out right afterwards, I have to say.
If you look really closely when he's talking to you after he dramatically chews on the piece of bacon, it looked like he spit a few pieces of bacon on you or something. Luckily, you were sitting far enough away.
That's chilling. No, that's true. But I have to say, I was talking to the producer, and before you go on TV, you hang out in something called the green room, and I was talking to the producer, and he's like, well, it's just so great that we have, we're getting this word out there and that we can have people like you and Rob Wolf on the show. And I had just sent you an email introducing myself to you the day before. And it's right. Like, Rob Wolf? And there you were. He's like, yeah, just right behind you. That's him. So it's kind of thrilling that we're finally coming around and doing this too.
It was super cool. There were a number of folks that have been to the Ancestral Health Symposiums that work with the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, the Food Freedom League, I believe. Like, there were some really great folks that made it on that show. I thought it was, for kind of a primetime news show where they just basically blast you through this stuff, it was actually pretty well done. I was reasonably impressed with it. So
Fun. The bigger story is that the media is – now, there is a shift, I think, in the media, and and I take a little bit of credit for that. I'm happy to say, that there's that Time magazine cover that was based on my book that came out, that was maybe a week and a half ago now, and then there was to be reviewed by like the Wall Street Journal and or be in the Economist. I mean, I think it's pretty much the first time that these ideas are getting out into the mainstream press in a pretty big way, that they're, we owe all of that to Gary Taubes, who really began all of this. But it's been a long uphill climb for over a decade now. So I think this is an important moment now, I think, in kind of nutrition history. So we'll see where it goes, but I'm encouraged.
Absolutely. And, people get, this was something else that Nina and I talked about briefly before I rolled the tape, as it were, that people get really wrapped around the axle of the protein, carb, fat kind of conversation, and I think they forget that when Gary's first piece came out, What If It's All Been a Big Fat Lie, this was just earth-shaking stuff, and particularly from my background. This was maybe 2000, 2001 that I believe that came out, and I had been tinkering with this paleo, low-carb kind of thing since about 1998, playing with cyclic ketogenic diets, getting educated about problems with gluten and different food intolerances and whatnot. But when Gary's first piece hit, it hit big, and it was there was a complete vacuum in the literature that was being published around nutrition, certainly in the media, that would paint animal products in any type of a favorable light. Like, it was really the long, dark tea time of the soul as far as that stuff goes. So, people get really wrapped around the axle of some of the details on this stuff. But again, to your point, the history of all this and just being able to get a legitimate conversation about the history and some of the backdoor shenanigans that have gone on with food policy and whatnot. It's really important to give some hat tips to where they appropriately apply. So yeah.
Well, so what I try to do in my book, which is called The Big Fat Surprise, is that I go back over some of the history that Gary Taubes covered, because you know, it's you have to just know that history. Not everybody knows it. Your listeners probably know it inside out, but I go back through the story of Ansel Keys and how he, his seven country study, and how he got the idea that saturated fat causes heart disease implanted into the American Heart Association in 1961, the very first anti-saturated fat nutritional guidelines. There's a little piece to that story that I add that I think is interesting, and which is that the American Heart Association was really this like backwater, sleepy cardiologist professional society until in 1948, when Procter & Gamble approached it and said, you know, we'd be happy to make you the designee of our radio show that we sponsor called the Walking Man Contest. And overnight, $1.7 million flowed into the American Heart Association coffers. This is in 1948, transformed it almost really overnight into, you know, chapters opened up all across the country, and it became the national behemoth that it's the number one biggest not-for-profit organization in the country. And that all began and was launched by Procter & Gamble's huge push in 1948. And coincidentally, Procter & Gamble, the American Heart Association was recommending it in those 1961 guidelines that Americans not eat saturated fat and instead eat vegetable oils, which was like Crisco oil, which was the product of Procter & Gamble. So, and in fact, there's an educational film where the medical director of the American Heart Association is posing with a bottle of Crisco oil. The story of how industry has been involved in this, in the history of these flawed nutritional guidelines, is one that I tell that story a bit in my book. And it's really fascinating because I think that we all, those of us who've read Gary's work, and, you know, we understand how there's just fundamental errors of science that went on, which was, you know, nutritional epidemiology being pushed to the limits of what it can tell us, weak science being used to justify a biased set of beliefs against fat and saturated fat, and how people, scientists seem to make mistakes of rushing into public health recommendations before there was good science to support them because they were so terrified about the heart disease epidemic. But there's also intertwined in that history is the role of food companies. And so that's a story that I try to tell a bit in my book about how these big food companies like, you know, General Foods, Standard Food, Best Food, you know, Kellogg's, they all grew up in the early part of the 20th century. They formed something called the Nutrition Foundation in 1941. And they knew that to get Americans to eat more of their products, they needed to influence nutrition experts at the source. Get you know, publish the journals that would, in which articles would appear, and give research grants to scientists at Harvard and you know, and other influential institutions. And they did that. They did that before the National Institute of Health did that. The National Institute of Health came later. You know, big food companies were in there first. So it's a pretty interesting story of how they were involved in this history all the way through. Even though, you know, again, it really was men of science making fundamental mistakes about what the evidence could really show that I think is at the heart of these mistakes. But food companies were in there too.
And do you feel like we're finally reaching a point between NUSI and then also, you know, your work and other work that we're finally getting to a spot where we're having somewhat of a legitimate conversation? Like you mentioned, you were just on featured in the New York Times, The Economist, and also Time Magazine itself, you know, is talking about this topic. Like, how is this thing changed, and is it really a legit change, or is this just another, you know, the ocean rushed in and now it's rushing back out, and you know, 2 months from now we're gonna see another flip flop on the story?
Well, when I started out researching this, sort of around the same time you did in the early 2000s, and I started calling nutrition scientists and asking them about some of these ideas about fat and saturated fat, and And back in those days, I would, there were many instances where scientists would say to me, you know what, if you're going to take the Gary Taubes line, I'm not even going to talk to you. We can't even talk. And sometimes they would be so cagey and fearful sounding that I would get off the phone shaking, like thinking, am I investigating nutrition science or am I investigating the mob? I mean, there was such an incredibly closed feeling in the early 2000s. And that's because just as a tiny bit of history in there, and this is also something that I explore in my book, which was how critics of the diet heart hypothesis were silenced. So, you know, what happened to scientists who, like Pete Ahrens at Rockefeller University, who spoke out against the prevailing idea that fat, saturated fat, caused heart disease? What happened to those people? What was the fate they suffered? And why did debate get silenced to the point where people are afraid even to talk about it to me? But over the last decade, there has really been, due to Gary Taubes, scientists read his book, and there has been more of a conversation, more of an opening up. I think it is a steady trajectory of opening up. Scientists have now done a lot of science. So there have been numerous really pretty rigorous clinical trials that have been done over the last decade that are looking at a high-fat diet and comparing it to a low-fat diet. I mean, back in the day of Atkins in the early 1970s, he was promoting, you know, something like a low-carb paleo diet, but there was no science to support him. So he had his thousands of clinical stories, his patient files, and he would point to them, but that's not science. So now that science has really been done, and including like long-term, two-year-long clinical trials, because it used to be that there was a lot of fears about what his diet would do if you were on it for a long period of time. There were questions about renal function and bone density loss. But those trials have now been done, and there are numerous scientists who are now swiveling around away from fat as the dietary culprit and focusing instead on sugar, you know, glucose, fructose. There are scientists at Harvard and Berkeley who have done meta-analyses of all the studies on saturated fat and concluded in two separate meta-analyses that saturated fats do not cause heart disease. So there are a number of scientists at a pretty high level who are now, who are shifting the focus away from fat and towards carbohydrates as, you know, another possible idea about what causes chronic disease, including obesity. So I think the conversation has irrevocably shifted. But it is also true that while there's this huge groundswell of interest in a lower carbohydrate diet and eating more fat and the whole paleo movement and these scientists at prestigious universities, it is still true that the expert panels that control our nutrition policy, so that those are two of them. One is at the American Heart Association and one is at the USDA. The USDA, which publishes our dietary guidelines, which have been used as the foundation for the USDA food pyramid, which everybody knows. So those two expert panels are moving in exactly the opposite direction. They are ratcheting back the amount of saturated fat that they recommend for Americans to eat. The last AHA panel recommended for, you know, if you think you might be at risk for heart disease, they were telling people to cut back their saturated fat to 4 to 5% of calories, which is like pretty much unseen in human history, except during periods of extreme deprivation, like in post-war cultures or during the Irish potato famine, or periods when humans have been starving. And those two expert panels are run by what I call the nutrition aristocrats, which are kind of a very small group of people that really run the nutrition policy in the country. That it's a pretty tiny handful. It used to be all men for a long period of time. Now there's some women on there, and it's the same people on both those panels. So we're going to have Now there's the new dietary guidelines. That panel is currently reviewing the evidence, and there's supposed to be a new set of dietary guidelines coming out in 2015. And, you know, it's very likely that those will be moving in an ever more saturated fat restricted direction, just like the AHA has, because it's the same people on those panels. So I see the nutrition conversation, while it is opening up, there's also this chasm. As you know, one community is going towards a low carb idea, and the other community is going towards an ever more restricted, pretty much nearly vegan diet.
Right.
And I don't know what's going to happen, but those are really diametrically opposed directions.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I tend to be a little libertarian leaning and have this faith in markets kind of winnowing this stuff out. And that's where, to some degree, I've actually just kind of, I wouldn't say turn my back on academia, but I have really not, I've been more excited about just getting people to do experiments of one, you know, N equals one, see how you look, feel, and perform. Let's see how blood lipids and inflammatory markers change with some experimentation in the clinic here in Reno. We definitely see, particularly in police, military, and firefighters, these people who are under extreme stress, bad sleep conditions, that they seem to benefit enormously from a limited glycemic load diet. Now, I will, and we're tracking this largely looking at LDL particle count as kind of our main, you know, theory of like a gradient-driven process of atherosclerotic plaques and that whole thing. Occasionally, we see somebody, and I'm not super sure on the numbers with this yet. We do see some folks that if they're doing quite a lot of saturated fat, that the LDL particle count will bump up on those folks. And so we will shift them, and you talk about the Mediterranean diet in your book, but we'll shift them to what we call kind of like a paleo Mediterranean diet, where they're getting more fat sources from monounsaturated fats, and it seems to pull that LDL particle count down a bit, and we're just now starting to do a little bit of analysis on these folks, and we're thinking that we've got like an APOE4 gene family, like Northern Europeans, that a certain branch of those folks seem to do a little bit better on kind of a paleo med. But the interesting thing is that we're definitely not pulling saturated fat levels below 7%, 10%. You know, I mean, it's when these folks start getting saturated fat up in the 15 and 20% of their total fatty acid pool that we see some problem in some people. So it's my hope that, you know, getting people to just self-experiment, and I see it as kind of a little bit of a logic tree. It's like, well, we, you know, try A, B, C. If A and B work, but C doesn't, then we can pop you to D. But, you know, I feel like we have a pretty solid rubric that isn't really that complex. You know, if a couple of these steps work, then great. If one or two of them don't, then we know some fallbacks that we can tinker with and then go from there.
Yeah, but you're basically putting your firefighters and people on a lower carb diet, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So,
yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that's the key, is that, you know, the USDA food pyramid, now my plate graphic, I mean, that's a 60% carbohydrate diet. And that's what's been recommended to Americans who have dutifully increased their fruits and vegetables and carbohydrate and their grains and over the last 30 years, and just look a lot sicker for it. So it seems like you're tinkering with a diet that is, you know, is a new diet.
Yeah.
You know, you're tinkering with something that looks a lot different than what most people are recommended when they go to their doctor's offices.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, to the degree that we get some more dense carbohydrate sources in there. And again, the police, military, fire scene, and I would even say medical professionals are interesting because they seem to show these diseases, you know, westernized diseases earlier in higher frequencies. And I think it's because they're just experiencing this full lifestyle shift, a negative lifestyle shift kind of on steroids. Like they don't sleep as well. They're under enormous stress. Their activity patterns are generally pretty broken. And so it's almost like when they do toxicology studies on rats or something, and they give these animals like super high doses of something like aflatoxin to figure out just how gnarly it is. It's like our first responder folks are being put on a highly toxic lifestyle, bad food, bad sleep, lots of stress, and this stuff is really bubbling to the surface. So even within this community, because we are trying to get these folks to lift some weights and do some metabolic conditioning and stuff like that, if we do a more dense carbohydrate source, it's only in the post-workout period. And then we're going with low glycemic load carbohydrates the rest of the time.
Right.
Actually really pushing a rather high protein intake because of the satiety signals that folks get from that. And we've had some pretty darn good success with that. I've talked about this before. We did a 2-year pilot study with the city of Reno police and firefighters, trying to modify their sleep, food, exercise, based off of cardiometabolic risk parameters that we've been tracking. We estimate that the pilot study alone has saved the city of Reno about $22 million. It has about a 33-to-1 return on investment. And now we have all of the police, all of the municipal workers, all of Sparks PD, and we're getting into the FBI and ATF and some different entities now, because the numbers are really compelling. And so that, I guess, you know, looping back to my point earlier, is that it's exciting that I see some shift happening in the academic scene, but I almost feel like this market-driven approach is going to be the thing that really turns this around. Like we may end up turning this around, having the problem solved, and then about 10 years later, the academics will be like, we've figured it out. And it's like, right on, cool. Good for you guys, yeah. You know.
I mean, there's an interesting thing that's happening with academics now is that they see that there is a shift happening. Some of them are jumping on board and saying, oh, we always knew that was true. And others are, you know, kind of old guard is really you know, it's basically saying, you know, you people recommending more fat and protein are killing people. It's interesting that you say like it's a market driven. One of the drivers of all of this new questioning comes from from athletes, like the community of people who really want to be fit, or like firefighters or, you know, who need to be fit. I'm just going to say as an aside, you know, apparently the LA Lakers, apparently they're all on a paleo diet.
Right.
So,
yeah.
But some of the original research in over the last decade has come up from basically academics who were also athletes. One guy named Jeff Volek was a powerlifting state champion at Indiana. Another one named Stephen Finney is a just huge biker hiker. And they came up, they were trained in, I mean, Jeff Volek's case, he was trained in kinesthesiology, and which is the study of movement, athlete, you know, and so there was a questioning, and these people importantly had not been schooled in nutrition science. So they came with really open minds. They had not been exposed to what was really the conventional thinking in the same way. I mean, we're in the third generation now where a universe of experts, doctors, mm-hmm. believe that fat and saturated fat cause obesity and heart disease and diabetes. And so these experts who were looking at this in a fresh way, they were not schooled in those ideas. They had other demands. They were interested in athletic performance. In fact, one of the first studies that Stephen Finney ever did was when he did an experiment at the University of Vermont in the 80s, seeking to prove that carb loading was a good idea, you know, before a marathon or something. Mm-hmm. And he showed the exact opposite. He's found that athletes, and this has now been shown, you know, especially endurance athletes, they do much better on a low carb diet. They're able to, they don't bonk, which is maybe a biking term, but you know, they can go for much longer periods of time with much more consistent energy. And their overall fitness is just much better. So So it's interesting to see that that's another kind of root and force of change that has moved the conversation in a different direction. You know, and I'm hoping to see something like, you know, the Parents for Whole Milk movement, because I think, you know, one of the sections in my book, which is new and I think kind of the most heartbreaking section of the book, is on women and children. Just that women and children were included in the low-fat dietary recommendations from 1970 on. It was, the American Heart Association who first kind of decided everybody should be on this diet, not just middle-aged men fighting heart disease. And they brought on women and children in 1970, zero data on women and children on the low-fat diet, zero. And with one exception, the Framingham study, which is the biggest ever study of risk factors, had looked at some women. And in fact, one of their inconvenient findings in 1971, which was that women over the age of 50, if they had higher cholesterol, that was associated with longer life.
Right.
But that wasn't published, that result, because it was so just impossible to square with everything that experts were saying about fat and heart disease generally, so, and cholesterol. So women were finally tested in the late 1990s in a series of clinical trials, and it was discovered that they did especially badly on a low-fat diet, the standard American Heart Association recommended low-fat diet. Their HDL, the good cholesterol, it turns out, drops quite precipitously on that diet. It drops for men too, but it drops even more for women, meaning their risk of having a heart attack was in fact going up on that diet. And and women really, you know, aren't told that. you know, women are pretty good compliers. They try especially hard to, you know, especially to stay thin and look good. They work hard at
Women are definitely the avant-garde of tinkering with new things, for sure, whether it's CrossFit or nutrition or what have you. They tend to be the early adopters.
Yeah, and they work really hard. You know, so they've been working really hard for the last, you know, 40 years at following a low-fat diet, too. I mean, most American women, right? And they look especially bad on it. And there was the Women's Health Initiative, which was like testing the low-fat diet on almost 50,000 women. And at the end of their following a low-fat diet for a decade, there was no improvement in obesity, any kind of cancer, diabetes, heart disease risk. I mean, it was just a total failure. For children, also no data, just no data at all on children. They were brought onto the low-fat diet because it was, you know, it was just assumed that if they had it was observed they had fatty streaks in childhood, and it was assumed that would cause heart disease down the line. And when they were finally tested on the low-fat diet, and there's only like a handful of very small experiments on children, hardly any at all, actually, but it turns out that they suffer nutritional deficiencies on low-fat diets. And
Wait, you're saying these things that are growing rapidly need things like fat-soluble vitamins to actually function?
Yeah.
That's crazy talk.
Crazy, right? And so, which is, I mean, the real, if there's a crime here, it's really that, you know, children have been brought up on low-fat skim milk. I grew up on skim milk. I mean, and you can't absorb the vitamins or the minerals in milk without the fat in it. Our government does not allow schools to, it doesn't cover whole milk in the school lunch program. And that's the same is true for the women and infant children program, nutrition program. And, you know, so these are huge tragic issues that, you know, I feel like what we need, part of what might and should happen next, I mean, talking again about, you know, where's the change going to come from? I'd like to see, you know, Mothers for Whole Milk, Parents for Whole Milk. You know, I just would like to see our children getting nutritious diets. I mean, children on a 40% fat or more diet eating mainly animal foods, that's when it seems that children grow best. And children's growth starts to falter on diets that are 25% fat or less. So, you know, the fat is really important. And as you say, you know, protein is satiating. Protein and fat, particularly together, provide satiety. And So to have more of those whole foods with whole fats in schools and as snacks, I think that will help go a long ways towards helping children, you know, fight the terrible obesity and diabetes crisis that we see today.
Well, and it's interesting, for the first time in American history, the average and maximum heights of our population are on a decline.
Right. And you know when that started?
Just about the time we cracked all this stuff open. So.
Yeah. It began pretty much just about when, you know, well, the first, again, that first advice to stop eating meat, cheese, butter, dairy, eggs was in 1961. And the U.S. government got on board with that in the late 1970s. Late 1970s is also when Americans stopped getting taller.
Right. And just to throw my nutcase political economic stuff in here, that was right at the time that we started intensifying our food production, subsidizing it, up until the 1970s, virtually all of our dairy and meat was also primarily grass-fed, because economically it didn't make sense to grain feed this stuff. And you can only really make that system work with subsidies. And as a spinoff of that, we also had all of this corn and wheat and rice and all these subsidized foods that would either go bad, or you had to figure out some long shelf life kind of options for it. And this is where I think this story gets really interesting. And I know that there's all kinds of I don't necessarily want to say bad blood, but maybe, you know, not the friendliest of stuff going on when you start talking about, say, like Gary and then Stefan Guinea, but this idea of the neuroregulation of appetite and hyperpalatability of foods, you know, potato chips and snack wells, which also used to wear an American Heart Association a recommended endorsement because it was zero fat but almost pure sugar. We started producing en masse these hyper palatable, long shelf life, highly refined carbohydrate foods. And so long as there was a very low fat content, then it was kind of like, hey, you know, knock yourself out, you're good to go. And so that's where I see all of these stories starting to dovetail together. And also in thinking about how to undo this, you kind of have to root it out at the source. Like a lot of these issues with the bad food, high fructose corn syrup, all the rest of that stuff, it looks comparatively cheap because it's subsidized. So maybe we should get in and change farm subsidies and maybe gut some of that stuff. As an aside.
Yeah, I mean, there have just been vast changes in agricultural and livestock production. You know, meat has changed to be leaner. Cattle are produced differently. We dedicate lots of our crops to fruit, very water intensive kind of crop. I mean, the changes that have come about in order for the entire country to get behind the low fat diet is just, you know, it's vast beyond imagining, really. And you know, we have food supply that supports a high grain, high carbohydrate, high fruit, low fat diet. And there's just so much of our food production system is meant to meet those low fat targets. I mean, there's a story that I tell in my book about how much there's so much bad press out there now about, you know, how the evil big food industry, and, you know, I'm not saying they're angels or anything, of course, but they are slaves to the dietary guidelines. Everybody is a slave to the U.S. dietary guidelines. And, you know, food companies know how important it is to that when consumers flip over the package and look at the fat content, I mean, all of those allowable amounts of fat or what's listed there, that's all determined by the USDA. So, and also the FDA. But, you know, there's a scene that story that I tell in my book about sitting in a vice president's office at ADM, and he's saying, you know, we just engineer foods backwards from the kind of claims that we make or what we want to appear on the nutrition fact panel. So if we want to make a low and saturated fat claim, which is what you can make, that's like that little thing on the front of the food package, this product, low and saturated fat, he's like, we just reverse engineer back from that. So, you know, we'll determine we're going to make some low-fat chocolate dairy dessert, but it's all based on what they want the fact panel to say. So it just shows you how slavishly they respond to the dietary guidelines. Like, that's where the power really lies, in that expert panel that controls the U.S. dietary guidelines.
That's going to be a tough nut to crack. That's going to be interesting over time.
It will be, yeah.
Nina, you talk also about the Mediterranean diet in a way that really hasn't been handled before. Can you flesh some of that out?
As a chapter about the Mediterranean diet that really kind of boggled my mind when I finally wrapped my head around what had happened with the Mediterranean diet, which is that it was, you know, the Mediterranean diet, of course, has existed in countries around the Mediterranean forever. It wasn't a low-fat diet. It was, you know, anybody who's been to Greece, Italy, Spain knows they eat a lot of meat and cheese. But the Mediterranean diet as a nutritional concept was introduced to Americans by Harvard scientists, epidemiologists in 1993. And that was, there were a number of reasons that that diet became beloved and famous, but one of the biggest ones was that the International Olive Oil Council, which is a body that's designed to promote the olive oil industry, they sponsored a series of what is widely known as like the best ever food science conferences in the history of nutrition all over the Mediterranean. So government officials, scientists, food writers, chefs, everybody went to these conferences on Crete and in Portugal and Turkey, and they just had the best ever time. They were junkets, basically, and there was olive oil was tucked into everybody's under the pillow and on packages, and there were tons of scientific sessions about olive oil in the Mediterranean diet. And it brought, you know, it produced a tremendous amount of research on the Mediterranean diet and cookbooks and magazine articles. And that was what those conferences were designed to do, which is to raise the profile of olive oil and the Mediterranean diet. It was also, the olive oil industry also invited other interested industries to help sponsor those conferences, like tomato producers and, you know, whoever else whose products would be promoted by. And that was organized also by this group called Old Ways, which is a not-for-profit group based in Boston. But so that's why we got the Mediterranean diet. It actually, the clinical trials showing that the Mediterranean diet is better than other diets, which we all believe now to be true, they show the Mediterranean diet looks better than the failed low-fat diet. So that's what those trials show. And then actually there's very little actual trial evidence, but to the extent that we have any evidence, it shows that the Mediterranean diet is better than the failed low-fat diet. And the question I ask in the book is like, well, it's very well possible that other traditional diets also look better than the American Heart Association's low-fat diet, which is proven to be a failure. I mean, there are low rates of heart disease in Mongolia, in West Germany after the war, in France, and they ate a lot more fat. But those diets weren't studied because nobody wanted to go to conferences in Mongolia or, you know, so we don't know about that. And they haven't been in head-to-head diet trials with the low-fat diet. But it's very possible that any diet would look better than the failed low-fat diet. So, and olive oil has also been researched just up the wazoo, and it nobody has been able to demonstrate that olive oil has any special heart disease fighting powers. I mean, monounsaturated fats are probably better than regular vegetable oils like soybean, safflower, peanut, corn, but olive oil does not. Consuming olive oil does not seem to fight heart disease.
Right.
That it can be shown scientifically, at least.
And we do have, it's small, intervention, paleo diet versus Mediterranean type diet. Stefan Lindeberg at the University of London, Sweden, did this type 2 diabetic heart patients and compared them again, a paleo diet versus a Mediterranean diet. One of the criticisms of the protocol was that the folks were counseled on how to eat and then, you know, kind of free living from there. And the folks on the paleo diet spontaneously reduced caloric intake, again, most likely because of more satiating foods, higher protein intake, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, basically these folks that were type 2 diabetic were no longer diabetic on the or peridiabetic were no longer in that category on the paleo diet. They had a barely statistically significant improvement in the Mediterranean diet, which you would expect. These folks had been eating, you know, a standard kind of, you know, bad westernized diet, and so I would have expected there to be you know, somewhat better improvements on the Mediterranean diet. And again, a very small sample size, not super long run, not balanced for, you know, isocaloric intake. But this is even that isocaloric story, I think, is intriguing again, because not everybody lives in a metabolic ward. So what are the nutritional approaches that actually get people to spontaneously eat less food? Like that clearly is some of the issue in this. You know, if you can provide a dietary regimen that people feel good and they're not hungry all the time and they're not going in and raiding the freezer right before they go to bed and eating, you know, God knows what, then we're probably moving in a good direction there. But this is where sometimes the academic story, you know, in science, you want to control as many variables as you can, which is great. But then when we actually get out in free living humans, there might actually be, and this actually caters more towards the dietetics view of this and maybe a little bit less towards Gary's view of this story, which is that, you know, they'll admonish us to eat fewer calories. And then it's like, well, okay, what's a dietary approach where that's actually doable in a free living population? And right, really, that doesn't get much airplay. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, people debate that. It's a really interesting issue. But I think, you know, one of the reasons that diets tend not to work in free living populations is that, you know, I mean, one of the reasons that that it looks like, oh, you know, Atkins diet, the so-called Atkins diet, looks almost always outperforms every other diet hands down. And then it seems like later on people backslide pretty badly after, you know, at some point a year down the line or what, and then they don't look so great anymore. And so the question is, okay, this diet is great, but it's not sustainable. That's sort of what the criticism has been by the academic community. And you know, I don't know if that's true, but I think that it's certainly a factor that every single medical professional out there thinks that the diet is bad for your health. So the amount of cognitive dissonance that anybody on the diet is suffering from is huge. I mean, if you had a universe of nutrition experts telling you, yes, this is a good diet for your health and you're not, it's not going to give you a heart attack down the line,
you might be more inclined to stick to it.
Yeah. You might be more inclined to stick to it. It might be more sustainable. Or if the food supply supported it better. You know, you go into a deli now, it is impossible to find one thing that is not, into a local, your corner bodega. I mean, everything is carbohydrates. So it's really hard to stick to a diet when a universe of experts are telling you it's going to give you a heart attack. And it's really hard. The food supply does not support it. So I feel like, I don't know if that criticism is valid, but it's weak right now. I mean, it's just, I think that it's there are reasons that people stay on and off diets and it's not at this point a legitimate way to criticize a high fat diet.
Right.
Anyway, so Rob, I hate to do this, but I have to get off the phone.
Oh, no worries. No worries. I actually have
a
meeting coming up here, too. I was late getting on here because my fantastic internet connection here in Reno. But Nina, it was great talking to you. I'm super stoked. Folks need to check out your book, The Big Fat Surprise. Your website is thebigfatsurprise.com. Any place else that folks can track you down? I know you have a number of YouTube videos out there also.
No, that's pretty much everything is on my website, okay, which is just thebigfatsurprise.com. So, yeah, that's a great place to go. So, and thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I feel like we could talk for hours, but we'll have to both get on with our days. But it's just really great to be on your show. Thank you.
Great having you, and I look forward to seeing you again. Take care.
You too.
Bye, Nina.
Bye-bye, Rob.